Let's cut to the chase. The world of work is changing. There's no stopping that change. Welcome to the Better Work Project, brought to you by the team at SoftEd. I am your host, David Mantica, and joining me as co-host is Andy Cooper. In this podcast, we will explore the changing world of work, what the future of work means, how it affects businesses and workers alike, and how we can create more productive and engaged workplaces. I hope you join us for the ride. Enjoy.
All right. We are back. Episode 12. A quick hello from Mr. Andy. Mr. Andy.
Hi.
Oh, that's such a wonderful hello. Very, very powerful hello. But I do have to ask you something, Andy. Do you celebrate Labor Day?
We do. We do, actually. Although we don't celebrate it the same time you do. So our Labor Day is coming up in the third Monday of October.
So why don't you celebrate the same time we do? We're not good enough for you guys?
yeah. Well, I think we probably chose I don't know idea. Actually, no idea why it's not the same day, but I think Labor Day seems to be random around this sort of time frame, different places of the world.
Now, if you're listening for the first time, the fun part about this top podcast is you get comments and thoughts from two different sides of the world. I'm here in Cary, wonderful Cary, C-A-R-Y, North Carolina. And Andy is talking to us from Wellington, New Zealand. So definitely different perspectives, wouldn't you say so, brother?
Indeed.
Now, I got to ask you one other question. Did you guys miss me when I was on holiday?
There's the famous retort on that, and that's there's only one way to know for sure. Can you leave again? Yeah, we did actually. In fact, you were missed so much that we moved in an important meeting just so that you could be there.
Oh, that makes my narcissism just glow. I'm glowing now with narcissistic pleasures. I'm probably not even word right, but who cares? Anyways, we got to jump into this thing because Gareth may actually leave us if we continue the banter too long here.
No, so, I'm still here.
There, good. And, you know, feel free to continue to make fun of the American because that's always a fun thing to do. So episode 12 is about psychological safety and building healthy cultures. And today we like to introduce our guest, Gareth Holbrook. And so, Gareth, can you go ahead and tell the audience about yourself?
Yes, I'm also living in New Zealand. I live at the north end in North London and spend most of my time working in Auckland. One way to describe what I do would be to say agile coach, but I try not to use that phrase anymore because people tend to get confused. So I am a coach. I'm interested in leadership, but the phrase I like to use is intentional ways of working. And that means being very conscious and intentional about how we work, the impact of our work, and our impact on other people. So that does include agile and lean and systems thinking, but also leadership and most importantly, language. So I'm doing a lot of studying at the moment and understanding the language of leadership. And in fact, the book I've just read by David Marquet, Leadership is Language, is something that really informs the way I like to work.
Man, great. So you got a lot of experience on this topic and we're really, really excited to have you. And we got a fantastic set of questions for you and Andy to banter on. So let's jump right into the introduction to the topic itself. So here we go, people. Close your eyes and go back to a time when you were Uber. And I'm not talking about Uber, the ride-sharing company here, not capital U. I'm talking about little lowercase u. When you were Uber, and Uber means outstanding or an extreme example. When you were Uber fired up about work, or about going to work. So you got your eyes closed, you're remembering this time when you were uber excited to go to work. What was going on? What were you doing? What were you working on? What was the management like? I think that Andy and Gareth would say that during that time you were operating in an environment of high psychological safety and you accepted that safety as real. So now the bigger question, this is a big question too. How many times has this happened to you and for how long? I'm hopeful some of you can answer it as having happened 50% or more during your career so far. The sad thing though is that's not usually the case. I bet most can say this happens about 10% or happened about 10% or less during their career. In this episode, we will discuss what is psychological safety. Can you build a psychologically safe environment? If so, how do you do it? Also, we will ask the question, can you make somebody psychologically safe? How do you do it, or why can't you? So let's jump on in the questions now, folks. Gareth, to you first, since you're the guest. And New Zealanders are nothing but hospitable, at the very least. Tell us, in as foundational way as possible, what is psychological safety?
Okay, well, it's not dissimilar, in at least at a neurological level, it's not dissimilar from physiological safety. So you know when you feel unsafe, when you're in the dark or when you're at home and you can hear somebody rattling the door, you feel unsafe. And you know when you feel safe. But psychological safety is pretty much the same thing. Imagine you're in a group of people and you want to tell a joke. Do you feel that you can tell a joke? And if it really tanks and nobody laughs, how do you feel? If you everyone laughs along with you and you feel that it was okay and it's part of the banter, you're psychologically safe. If you feel ostracized or feel guilty, then that's psychologically unsafe. And it's really important, not only in groups of people around a campfire telling jokes, but when we're at work, do you feel safe that you can speak up? Or are you in a meeting feeling, I'm not going to say anything just at the moment? And that's the best measure.
I love it that you have the joke indicator. And man, I certainly told some doozies where nobody said anything. So I'm sure I was psychologically unsafe at that point in time. So Andy, what do you want to add to that from a foundational starting perspective?
Well, firstly, I'd like to congratulate Gareth for bringing back the campfire. So Michael's session a few weeks ago. So we appreciate you bringing that reference back.
Andy, we were all over the campfire, so that's why he likes to talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think Gareth did a fantastic job in summing it up. But, you know, if we think about the to my mind, it's really the belief that I can have or that I can have within a team free exchange of ideas and not feel any personal risk by that.
Excellent. This is good. So that foundational level, I think it really helps people, you know, get a handle of it. And I love the concept of the physical versus psychological being very similar from how it makes you feel. Now, the second question grouping is more tied to storytelling. And I think, you know, this topic being so ethereal in some ways, you know, hearing a story about it is almost as powerful as, or probably even more powerful than, you know, getting more detailed understanding through conversation. So Andy, starting with you, you know, we're having a bit of fun here. Tell us a time in your career when you were psychologically safe. What was going on and what made it so?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think sometimes these situations come out of, you know, what was actually quite a tough time. So I remember, this is quite a long time ago, when I moved across to Australia, I was asked to move over there to lead a part of the marketing team in for a software company. And at the pretty well the same time I arrived there, we went through quite a down period in our sales and in what was a very sales-led organization. So there was a very strong move and, you know, desire for us to lift our performance in the business. And as a marketing team, we were tasked with helping do that. So what I remember very clearly out of that was that, you know, as a team, there was about 12 of us. We broke into small sub-teams. We had a very clear goal about what we were trying to do. And in a very short period of time, we were able to execute and pull off some pretty amazing campaigns that generated quite a bit of potential. And I think more importantly, hope within the broader organization. And what I recall out of that was just the feeling of, you know, we're up against it, but we trust each other. We're in there to help each other, you know, we're going to get it done. And we want to have this leave, a lasting impression on the business in terms of what does marketing mean to them and how can marketing help? So, now, yeah, I remember that clearly.
Andy, on that story, you didn't mention management. So My question to you was, if the management was more restrictive and more controlling at that point, would you have had the same feelings and remember it the same way, even if you were successful?
So there's different levels and layers. So some parts of the management organization were quite closed and restrictive, but my immediate boss was, I think, created that culture or allowed us to create that culture. And I was a manager within that team. So we were able to sort of guide that somewhat ourselves. But as a collective, we decided that that was the only way. And despite some of the noise that was coming from above, we decided we just had to operate in that sort of high trust mode.
That's interesting. All right, Gareth, tell us your story.
Yeah, so I always go back to a company I worked for in the mid-1990s in the UK. It was an engineering company designing and building equipment for broadcasters, so standards converters and digital TV coders. And I was a young product engineer, product development engineer, and I was developing power supplies for this equipment. So these were big industrial racks. And I spent 6 months on this project, and we got a third party to develop these power supplies. And the prototypes came, we spent thousands of pounds on these prototypes. And as soon as you plugged them in, they literally turned to smoke. and it actually set off the fire alarm.
It's like the Office. So in the US, the TV show, The Office, for the US version, the printers that the company that bought them had printers that would come on fire after 20 minutes. Anyway,
so as an engineer, it was I was responsible. I'd made a few errors in the design and hadn't fully cross-checked with what the third parties were doing. So when they built the prototypes and we got them, they were no use, and so we lost a lot of time, and it cost a lot of money. So I was embarrassed about that, as you can imagine. And my weekly meeting with my boss, I went into his office, and keeping the door open was this big box filled with power supplies. And I looked down at them, and he laughed, and he said, "Look, I'm not going to beat you up. I know you're beating yourself up about this." He said, "I'm going to put this down to your training budget." He said, "You're going to learn from this." And it genuinely was this company was it was different to all of the other ones I'd heard about. It was around about 1996. The chairman was he was a professor of economics in London. He was ordained as a Buddhist monk. And he was a Buddhist Marxist economist. But it was a really weird company, but they created this environment where you could experiment, you can try things. And if things go wrong, you don't blame the person, because you know we're all in this together and we can learn together. And because of that, it enabled me to learn a lot more rapidly than I would do if I felt threatened.
That's really interesting on the Buddhist monk economist. And the story is fabulous. I love the tie-in to the training budget. But here's my question for both of you. And I think about my story, I'm not going to share it, but I was a young man as well. All three of our stories have a tendency to show us as younger folks. Does psychological safety get harder the older we get and the more baggage we carry? You know, is there any ties to that? Gareth, any thought on your side?
I think so, because it can be a learned behavior. You know, learned helplessness, for example. I think it may that there may be greater challenges as you get older, but I still think with the right kind of leadership and creating the right kind of micro habits, you're never too old to feel safe. And it's not so much your own interpretation of the world around you, but the people around you as well, and the behaviors and language that they use can help people become build that psychological safety.
Yeah, Andy, your thoughts on that? Because we just did the whole unlearning podcast as well. And, you know, it just became apparent when all three stories are tied to us in our 20s or early 30s.
Yeah, I agree with Gareth as well. I think it's context-based. So, you know, you can be damaged, I think, by a bad, psychological unsafe environment. And that can make it harder when you join a new team or a new organization to sort of trust people. But you know, if that team has a good spirit, you know, operates well together, and the leader really fosters open discussion and, you know, and treats people well, then it can, you can certainly change that. You know, again, I think it's that physical feeling that Gareth was talking about as well. If you start feeling safe, you start seeing it is safe to say what you think, you do have a voice, then you will learn over time that it is.
Interesting. Now, you've segued, Andy, very nicely into the next question. I'll start with Gareth on it. Would be, you know, what are some of the elements that go into building a culture that would give me, someone like me, a better chance of accepting the psychological safety available? So, Gareth, your thoughts on this?
So the first thing that springs to mind is patience. And what I mean by that is you cannot change a culture overnight. In fact, you can't change a culture at all. A culture's a lagging indicator. It's a representation of how people feel. But as a leader, there's many things that you can say and do which will over time build that culture. And I'm going to refer back to now the last few years I've been leading an agile practice as a fintech up here in Auckland. And the first thing I did was, as the leader of these agile coaches, was bring some humility and openness and curiosity. And in my language, I really try and avoid the binary affirming language like, we're good to go, right? Because that closes down conversation. It's a binary. It's yes or no. Instead, I ask questions like, what am I missing? So it shows vulnerability. The next thing is to seek feedback, to be open to feedback, because it shows that I'm still on this learning journey and it's a partnership together. And when you seek feedback, it's better to give feedback. It's easier to give feedback. The next thing that leads on to feedback is being, I'm inspired by Kim Scott's work in her book, Radical Candor, and demonstrating that you care personally, but being very meticulous about challenging directly. So you've got to show you care. You can't be obnoxiously aggressive, but then you've got to challenge people and say, look, that behavior doesn't match my expectations. But generally it's, you've got to show you care. You've got to show empathy. You've got to show curiosity and learning. And all of this is around the kind of language that you use and also the body language and being very sensitive to the impact that may have.
The body language. Have you seen that as a failure point where they say one thing and their bodies, their motion tone is saying a totally separate thing?
Totally. Especially, I mean, very nuanced things like the position of the hands or even the eyebrows. And you know, you might be saying one thing, but people know you mean something else. And I have to admit, I talk a good game. I'm not the best poker player. So if I'm irritated by something, people can tell. But the flip side to that is I'm very authentic. And I think people pick up in authenticity. So I say what I think, because if I say one thing and think another, people will tell, and then they will try and second guess me. And then that causes a incongruence, which is threatening. So I think authenticity is the thing that I failed to mention.
All right, I got two more follow-ons for you, then we'll get to Andy. I'm sure he's about ready to slap me because he's chomping at the bit. But can you teach someone to be authentic? So psychological security and authenticity definitely tie together. Can you teach someone that?
I think the only thing I could say is I model that behavior. And then I demonstrate in an organization that it's okay to be authentic, to speak truth to power, to say what you really think. And I think if it becomes a behavior commonplace, then people will align to it and it will become habitual. And therefore that becomes cultural.
That's fun. That's a fun one. That's a really cool answer you just gave there. That's interesting. And then the lagging indicator, culture is a lagging indicator. Love that. Is it a 6-month lagging indicator, a 9-month lagging indicator? You know, how do you judge the change?
Yeah, and this is the hard thing. I posted on LinkedIn only a few days ago a Simon Sinek video where he was saying it's not about intensity, it's about consistency. And he uses the metaphor of your teeth. You go to the dentist once, twice a year. But if that's all you do, your teeth will fall out. You have to brush your teeth every single day. How many times do you have to do it before it works? I don't know. Can I miss a few days? Sure. How many? We don't know. But the point is, it's those little micro behaviors that you, by themselves, you notice nothing, but they have to progress over a long period of time. And it's the same with culture. So, I would have an end of year review with my team I know it's old school, we just had to do it. But there would never be any surprises because I would be giving them constant and persistent feedback on the good things and the bad things as we went through. So that, and you have to be very authentic and sincere in the positive feedback, but and that opens up to the redirected feedback where we can improve. But you've got to do it little and often and progressively. And you're right. I mean, and then their response is a reflection of not just the immediate instance that's just happened, but of months and months of your relationship.
So, Andy, you've got so much to play with here. Go for it. What do you want to attack? But not in the way, I meant, what do you want to jump into?
Well, interesting. The comment around the authenticity is an interesting one because I've sort of been pondering that one. And I think a few people have heard my sort of perspectives. I've listened to a podcast from Adam Grant talking about this, and it sort of piqued my interest. And the concept that the issue I have with authenticity per se is that it can be an excuse to be an a-hole as well, because I'm being authentic. But that may not be appropriate either. So how I look at authenticity to me is that there's different elements of that. So I can be authentic and react and be different depending on the context. So me as a father, me as a friend or as a colleague I can be slightly different, but still be authentic depending on what values I'm choosing to develop or show at that point in time. So I think that's how I would look at authenticity. Just firstly, is that it's that shouldn't be an excuse for bad behaviors or anything. That should really just be, to my mind, an opportunity to reflect your values. So that's one thing. In terms of psychological safety, a couple of things that I think what makes this hard. We're going to cover this a bit more later, but I think what makes this hard is that it requires a whole bunch of new skills that leaders and often team don't have. Listening being one. So listening's, actually being able to listen carefully and thoughtfully is a skill that's not taught or well developed in a lot of people. Related to that is questioning as well. So rather than telling, it's more the ability to stay curious for longer, as Michael Bungas-Daniel would talk about. And that means that instead of me telling you what I think all the time, it's more being asking questions and helping you, develop your thinking through good listening. So listening and asking are skills that we all need to develop, in my view, and have much better to be much better at to really help develop this psychological safety.
My aha moment for both of you right now is this idea of consistency. So when I start hearing about psychological safety, I hear all the happy, happy, make everybody happy, happy, everybody joy, joy, everybody worky, happy, happy, happy. But when Gareth started really digging into consistency and the going to the dentist is a phenomenal way of pointing it out. It's almost like bad parenting. The worst parenting is you go in and you give the kid a ton of gifts for Christmas and then ignore the crap out of the kid for the rest of the year. They don't know what to expect. So I'm almost getting the sense that if you want a psychologically safe environment, yet you're going to have a tough culture where, there's expectations and things get done. As long as that's consistent, then some people can grasp psychological safety in that because of that consistency. And then there's authenticity in that consistency. Gareth, is that what you were trying to, that's what you were coming out with when you were talking about that?
Yes. You show vulnerability and you do it consistently, which means showing trust. And trust means putting in other people's hands the risk that they could harm you psychologically. So when you show vulnerability, you show it safe to open up. And over time, people sense that this is the new normal and therefore will align to that way of working. And that's when we connect and when we have that deep sense of trust.
But now spinning it, if you have a culture that is maybe a little fixed mindset of culture, but it's consistent, will some psychological safety occur in that environment because of the consistency or no?
I think it will. But it takes great courage, right? And this is what leadership is all about. You need to be the first mover and to demonstrate trust. You can't just say, you know, my door's always open. I trust you. You're empowered. You have to prove it. And so if the culture is such that there is an absence of psychological safety, or like you say, a fixed mindset, it can only emerge out of that through modeled behavior, which comes from the leaders.
Andy, what's your thoughts on that consistency thing? And, you know, if you're even going to have a culture that maybe might have some of the attributes of, you know, what you want as a really strong psychological safety environment, with consistency, you can generate an aspect of it or portion of it. Or is that not possible?
No, I think it is. Because, you know, again, if we come back to the, you know, we talked about before about how, you know, how do people feel? So that consistency can help people feel safe in a, you know, turbulent world. So that can be helpful. I just think it's not enough.
Yeah, that's what I think I was thinking about there. So now what happens is if I have a fixed mindset, consistent environment, I have learned helplessness. So I have a bunch of people just doing what they're being told, and I don't get all the benefit that a highly empowered, psychologically safe environment with democratized decision-making can have. Does that make sense? Either one of you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could lead to low energy. You know, it could lead to low output, low outcome, poor outcomes. So, but you could still feel safe.
Yep. That's interesting. Okay. There has to be that other element which we're talking about. So jump into the question four, and Andy, you started going into it and you're going to be first on this one, is what are some ways psychological safety is squashed, especially the type that generates the democratized decision-making? And does it happen a lot without leaders even knowing it?
It happens frequently, is probably the reality. And I think it's because it's the environment that we're often in. So we're often in high pressure. You know, we go from meeting to meeting. We don't prepare enough for each meeting. So as a result of that, there's a sort of learned, you know, unintentionality. I don't know if that's a word, but I don't think it's something that a lot of leaders want to do, but just perhaps they just haven't prepared enough or thought enough about how to intentionally create that environment. So unintentionally, what happens is that we don't monitor share of voice. So we allow dominant people to speak for too long. And we don't allow the quiet people an opportunity to say anything. And that's unintentional often, but happens frequently. We unintentionally allow sexist language. We unintentionally allow, you know, sort of, I think, bad behavior in the sense of behavior that stops people talking and wanting to take, you know, and feeling safe to say something. Yeah, there's a lot of things that lead into this. But as I say, I think a lot of it is unintentional from a lot of people, but it requires some real shift in their mindset and their behaviors and habits to make that shift.
Gareth, your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Anders just said. And I'd just like to pick up what you mentioned about equal airtime. And the Google Aristotle project picked this up. Not many people realize this, but you can measure the psychological safety of a team by the Gini code almost. So if you know in economic equity, you know, wealth inequality, there's the Gini code, and you can do the same with people. So if you have a group of three people where the most senior person does all the talking, that's a one. If you have two people talking and not and one person silent, that's a 0.5. And what we want to try and do is have a lowest voice Gini code as possible. And that's something that you can pick up as a coach. You can observe the team and see, does everybody have roughly the same amount of conversational airtime? And that's really important. And it can be unintended and people can be unconscious about it. So that's something that I really focus on. I think as well, the other thing I've noticed is the language of leaders. So Unintentionally, again, leaders can have coercive language. So they give instructions, not information. So rather than just pointing out, this is what I see, they say, this is what we should do. And then that can drive, it's like an overbearing control on people, and they feel that they cannot resist that. And I think that's really important, the coercive language. And also things like when something goes wrong, rather than that starting with a why, which can tend to be accusationary, and this talks to the Michael Bungistania work, is start questions with what. You know, what do you see? What can we do about this? What am I missing? So I'm very sensitive when I'm in organizations, is the language of the executives and the senior leaders, and also that distribution of conversational turn taking. I think those are really important aspects.
Interesting. So we talked a lot about the, you know, the cultural side related to the leadership and the leadership responsibilities. We have thrown a little bit back on the individuals within the environment, but that's what this next question really digs into. So can you have the most psychologically safe environment and somebody not accept it? Is that possible? And if so, why? And then my question is, how does self-esteem fit into this? So Gareth, you first on this.
Yeah, so I think it is possible. So in some cases, I've been very open and vulnerable to the team, and on occasion, the team have taken advantage of that, or individual members have taken advantage of that for political gain. And that's obviously a throwback to their previous experience at other organizations, or even elements of the culture prior to my being there. Yeah. I think that's just a risk you'd have to take as a leader. I think over time, people tend to harmonize towards a group identity of culture. And if there are outliers, the group over time will reject them or bring them in. And so we need to be patient, I think. So I think it is possible to bring people in over time.
But do you think that someone ultimately may not have the self-esteem to accept the fact that they're safe?
Yeah, and this is why it's important as a leader to build that self-esteem, and to reassure people and to demonstrate the value, and it has to be authentic and sincere. A project manager I led a few years ago, she wrote a blog about leadership, and it really warmed my heart because I wasn't aware of it at the time. But I gave her end of year review, and obviously throughout the year, I'd done that consistent positive and redirected feedback. But as a throwaway comment at the end, in a review, I gave her gushing praise and a few things we could work on. But a throwaway comment, I said, I want to thank you for this year because you know what? You make me look good. So thank you for making me look good. And it was a little bit jokey, but it was genuine as well. But I didn't realize this at the time, but she took that away and it really warmed her heart to the point 6 months later, she wrote a blog on leadership and made a specific reference to that. And I think that's what we need to do as leaders, is encourage people's self-esteem to evolve.
Andy, your thoughts on this? And I have an additional follow-up after that.
Yeah, I think people will come in with their own beliefs and you know, baggage sometimes from prior examples or systems they've been in. So that's always going to be a factor. But I think as Gareth points out, hopefully over time, they see that your intentions are good and, you know, are welcomed into that. One technique I've seen people talk about quite a bit, you know, as a way of creating a shared understanding is, because I think that's a key part of it as well. I think we trust each other better when we know each other, is this concept of a user manual. So it's getting me to talk about how to work with me better. So I literally create like a user manual for myself. And I've seen these done quite well. And it seems to be an evolving area of that people are talking about now as being, how, you know, something that's worth doing. So that again helps people figure out how to work with each other better. So I think that's part of it as well.
I just love this concept. My follow-up is a taking advantage. So in things we're talking about, to build a psychologically safe environment, you want to make yourself vulnerable, and making yourself vulnerable shows weakness. And weakness can be manipulated, as Gareth was talking about. Are there any techniques to protect yourself from that? Or Gareth, you just, like you said, you just go back and it is what it is.
It is. That's the role and the responsibility of being a leader. I'd just like to pick up on what Andy just said, and I totally agree about that connectedness within the team. And tell a quick story about a team that I led. We'd been together for a year, and I use the practice of the river of life, which you can Google. It's a way of people expressing, you draw out a river and talk in the metaphor of a river of your life. And I usually do it with new teams to build that connectedness. So we see that we have shared experiences, or, there's things to talk about. But in this case, I did it with a team that we'd been together for about a year. And normally the river of life takes 30 minutes or, maybe an hour. It doesn't take too long. But this team, because we'd already connected quite well, it took us to a next level of depth of connectedness. So one lady there had grown up in Kuwait and was there during the invasion of Saddam Hussein in 1991. And her family were there, and it was very traumatic. And none of us knew this. But you would also not recognize that at the same time, my brother was serving in the Allied forces invading Kuwait. So there was a connectedness between us that we could then explore beyond that. But we normally take an hour, but this time with this team, it took 3 hours. There was tears, there was hugs at the end. And then that team, beyond that, we became so close. And so that openness and vulnerability, you just have to show it, and there is risk in it, but it is worth it. The reward is much worth it.
Well said, story. That was really cool. Andy, thoughts on that side?
Thoughts? Yeah, I think that's an undervalued part of this as well, is that as Gareth said, that connectedness is is, to my mind, a key part of building trust, building that feeling of safety is through connection.
All right. So this is the last question before we kind of wrap things up. This podcast has a lot to do with adaptive problems. We talk about very complex and complicated environments and adaptive problems. And it seems to me that, psychological safety may be critical in the handling the adaptive problems and complex systems when we're dealing with knowledge workers. Is that right? I mean, at this point, without that, this type of psychological safety, adaptive problems are very difficult to solve. Andy, your thoughts first, because you do spend, some time on the subject and doing a lot of training and research.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it comes down to, like we talked about before, it certainly helps. So, you can probably address or tackle complex problems without it, but it's just going to be a lot harder. And it's probably going to take a lot longer. And you're probably going to get, perhaps not always, a worse outcome, because you're not going to get the clarity of thought that probably comes from psychologically safe teams and environments where, issues can be talked about, raised and discussed quickly, and then an action. A first step, an experiment, whatever you want to call it, can be developed as a result of that. And it may take a lot longer, or it may be a lot harder without psychological safety.
Gareth, your thoughts on adaptive problems and psychological safety?
Yeah. So when at the beginning of this podcast, I did mention that at a neurological level, physical safety and psychological safety are the same thing. And I'm actually proud of myself. I haven't got geeked out into the neuroscience behind this yet. And up to now, I've spoken in relative plain English. But I just want to dip into that, because the thing is, when you're psychologically unsafe, your brain reverts back to the amygdala and the limbic system, and it's fight or flight, and you become very narrowly focused on survival. And you release things like norepinephrine. And what this means is it limits your ability to learn, and it entrenches a poor experience on the poor recollection of the experience. Mm-hmm. The problem is you can't solve complex adaptive problems in this state, because your prefrontal cortex is excluded from the thinking, and also your corpus callosum, which is the connection between the right and left hemisphere, is not as activated, so you can't think holistically. So the point is here, we need to, at a neurological level, we need to create the safety in order to activate the prefrontal cortex and make the right decisions such that we can have that executive brain and solve problems. You cannot solve complex problems when you're feeling unsafe. It's that simple.
So basically, if you're walking into a major transformation project with a team, you know, conducting a river of life session to connect that team, including the leaders, second, third, fourth level leaders, you won't get fourth, of course.
I would go much further than that and say, I won't, within reason, I won't affect any agile practices in a team until I'm satisfied that the leadership exists and the culture enables it. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. People will follow the practices when you're looking and then revert back. They won't believe in the practices and they won't truly be experimental and probabilistic. They will still be expecting determinism and certainty and feel unsafe. So you're not hiding to nothing. There's no way to transform without that precondition of safety.
Really strong science-backed comments there, Gareth. Really, really strong. And with that, we're going to kind of wrap up with some final thoughts. And Andy, we'll let you do final thoughts first, and we'll let our guest Gareth close us out, and hopefully we'll get him back another time. So final thoughts, Andy.
Sure. So I think this is with Google, Amy Edmondson and many others have made this whole topic of psychological safety, you know, something that that it's sort of brought to the attention of organizations, leaders. And so I think it's going to become one of these topics that we start unpacking more and more, and realize while it's actually where we want to be, and we know that it works well, and we talk about experiences of how we feel, which is good, it's actually quite hard. So what that is going to require is a sort of, to my mind, a real focus from organizations and leaders themselves to rethink what their role is and rethink the skills they need to be successful in that role. So things like I mentioned before, like coaching, questioning, listening, are all skills that you will need to have and exhibit and do to create psychological safety. So these are not things that exist in a lot of leaders. So that these are new skills that we have to develop for this to become something that happens frequently.
Gareth.
Yeah. So my closing thoughts are the thing that really informs me in this area is the work of David Marquet, the United States submarine commander. His book, Turn the Ship Around, I've read several times now. And where he changed the culture on board the submarine, which is not a safe environment, obviously, and things can go horribly wrong on a nuclear submarine. But he changed from a permission-based culture to an intent-based leadership. And then his most recent book, it was only published this year, Language is Leadership, talks about all of these things, about the coercive language and how to ask the right questions. But more importantly, it's got some really strong case studies from Space Shuttle Challenger to a ship that sank in Bermuda and other case studies around the world, and what we can actually do as leaders using the simplicity of language to create that psychological safety.
Man, I can still remember my one foray into it was telling my VP of sales that outside of walking around the office naked, he was empowered to get things done and do it the way he felt best, as long as ethically sound. So yeah, that was my foray into using language to try to create psychological safety. This has been a phenomenal session. You both have such rich and deep experience on this complex topic. I want to thank you both, and we're going to end episode 12. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of the Better Work Project. If you like this episode, please be sure to rate, review, and tell your friends and colleagues about it. If you have specific suggestions or ideas for future podcasts, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. Continue to fight the good fight. We'll see you the next time on the Better Work Project. Thank you.